Paddy Power and the Football Show, the greatest football partnership since Diofen Heskey.
You're welcome along to Monday's Football Show. Thanks for the Kit Kat, Dan.
No worries.
It was within that 60 seconds.
It was a sort of a.
Go on air.
It was a test, yeah.
I couldn't enjoy it.
You sort of wolfed it down there.
I did.
Sort of not that wasn't a great sporting moment.
No, it wasn't the highlight of my day, and I didn't even get to enjoy that little bit of Kit Kat,
no.
That generosity that you showed. But thank you nonetheless.
Just trying to be helpful.
Dan McDonald's in studio. 53106 is the text number. A little bit later on, we'll hear from David Myler and from John Egan, who were both alongside Stephen Doyle at Molineux yesterday for Wolves against Sheffield United. A 1-1 draw in that one. We are going to talk about the Ballon d'Or, Lionel Messi, best footballer in the world. Who could have predicted? Beat Virgil van Dijk.
Yeah, so
Cristiano Ronaldo third.
I'm sure Liverpool fans will take that well.
You can't really make a case for Van Dijk being better than Messi.
It's a tough opponent to face, you know. I know, like Ronan spoke about earlier on when we were in, and certainly in terms of the value and the importance to the team, obviously Van Dijk is way up there, but they also have a brilliant front three as well. You know, they didn't just win the Champions League because of one player.
He was the most important player in a team that won the Champions League, that got to 97 points in the Premier League. And he won the Did he win the Nations League? No, they got beaten in the final by Portugal, didn't they?
Yes, I think they did. I mean,
that's what cost them.
That's already dropped out of my memory pretty quickly.
It cost them, though.
I remember England and Switzerland were the other two teams in it. England losing. Fun. But
you're dissing the Nations League now.
Beyond that, no, Nations League was way as all of us bores who pointed out before the Nations League started, this could end up being pretty important for nations like Ireland, as was proven. And maybe if we'd just taken it that small bit more seriously and realised maybe winning one of the home games, he might be at home for the playoff in March rather than away. So at least we're well prepared for the next Nations League. That when we're trying to talk about it, saying, "Well, what does it even matter?" We're Ireland. It will matter eventually because we will always be on that cut line.
I still don't think people will fully accept the importance of the Nations League, which will be Stephen Kenny's first games in charge if we were to qualify. There's six of them at the end of next year.
Yeah. And
Kenny will be facing into.
And it does seem like they're going to try and make the Nations League remain important. So it's possible the top two ranked Nations League teams who don't qualify for the World Cup automatically might be thrown into the World Cup playoff picture. So a team like Ireland, who's in like B, there would be an incentive to do as well as you can, and you never know, it might matter. So
more Nations League chat coming away next Monday night. Exclusively on
apologies to everyone who's just about to turn off. This is the end of the Nations League.
The problem is there's about six people in this country who understand fully how the Nations League work, and it's so dull that like really the only people who find it interesting.
And it doesn't matter. Like it doesn't matter how many times you explain it. You still get questions every time you raise it.
The weird thing, actually, I've just thought of it, is you were in Bucharest for the weekend where the draw was taking place for Euro 2020.
Everyone was in it.
We were in it. And
do I realise that only...
Again, really cares.
Only 19 teams from UEFA weren't in the draw on Saturday.
Wow.
Out of 55. There was 36 teams represented in the draw. So I had to look through it and see who was the best team not in the draw. Or like the highest rated team not in the draw was Greece. But aside from Greece, like the only teams that aren't in the Euros now, like Slovenia, Estonia, like not established teams, qualifiers, you know, Cyprus have missed out. Like, I mean, it's not actually a shock really. So I mean, everyone had a sort of a vague interest in the draw on Saturday, but a lot of teams didn't really have that much interest at all because they don't even know if it means anything for them. It was really strange being there from an Irish perspective.
Was Mick McCarthy there?
No, there was an FAI, Noel Mooney and Donal Conway were there from the FAI. There obviously was a lot going on. There was a World Cup meeting on Friday. And obviously with the FAI situation at the moment, every meeting and discussion and chat, you know, bit of discussions they have. It was probably a very worthwhile trip from a working perspective. But in terms of the actual main event, it was very much a sideshow. Sideshow from the Irish. It's so odd. But it took all the suspense out of the draw. Mm. Like for Wales, for example, I was talking to the Welsh people who were there, that they went to the draw knowing they were either going to be in one group or another group. And they knew who two of their opponents, I think, were before they got there. Or sorry, no, they just knew they could be one of two groups. So there was no moment of like, you know, you don't want to be in this group. You know, there was a minor version of that with this amazing group with Germany, Portugal and France. But for some other teams, their fate was predetermined before they got there. So, I mean, UEFA are never going to do anything like this again.
It was a strange situation as well in that people are looking at it in slightly different ways. So from an Irish point of view, if Ireland do qualify, it's actually a reasonably good draw. It's Poland, Sweden, Spain. So
it's tempting you.
they play Poland and Sweden in Dublin, and then you finish up in Spain. So ideally you're in a position, you're going to Bilbao for that final game, having already qualified, having one of those top three spots.
Yeah.
That's the ideal scenario. The other scenario, which doesn't really bear thinking about, is that one of, say, Bosnia or Slovakia win that. And then you have this little mini league of Bosnia, Poland, Sweden playing all their games in Dublin.
Yeah.
So the first three games are between those three teams, which from a Dublin tourism point of view, I guess, is very good that the Swedes will bring the Swedes will bring a huge crowd. I'd imagine the Poles will bring a huge crowd.
Everyone was buzzing about getting the Poles. The Poles there, I mean, people have been to the Ireland-Poland games in the Aviva and the one in Croke Park where I think the friendly, where there was more Polish people there than...
Yeah.
Like, there's going to be a major tournament feel around the Poles. The Polish delegation are coming to stay in Ireland. They're going to base themselves here. They were bouncing around the place thinking this is going to be fabulous. But I know what you're saying, that if it's Bosnia or Slovakia playing those matches, they're not the most glamorous games, but I think there's a chance that those games would sell out because of the Polish and the Swedish travel.
Well, I think an awful lot of the games, because Ireland has such a high demand, an awful lot of the games are pretty much sold out anyways. Yeah, they're not dependent, because I know I bought tickets, went in the lottery, suddenly found myself spending £500 in tickets.
Yeah.
Two tickets for the first game, but also the dream ticket. Two tickets for the last 16 game.
That's the one.
Which is getting
That's
people
the golden
excited.
Ticket now. Yeah.
Which could well be England against Germany. Could be a repeat of last year's World Cup final. Could be Croatia against France.
Yeah.
But it will be the winners of the England-Croatia group against the second place team in the Germany-France-Portugal group.
Yeah, it's going to...
Those tickets are going to be hot property.
That's going to be the best game in that round.
I'm not saying I'm putting mine up for sale.
No.
I'm just saying.
And I'm not suggesting that you're not a man of means, but I think that the fear for the earlier group games would be that some people who have no issue with money might have put in for a load of tickets for those games, and then they can get away with not showing up.
Right.
You know, if it's Slovakia, you'll need to drain you'll sell them for whatever. You know, you'll do whatever. Like, whatever it takes. Like, there is an official portal for people putting their tickets, and maybe Poles and Swedes will snap them all up through that.
Yeah.
But I think that it could have been worse in terms of Ireland not being there and some of the teams that could have come to Dublin. I think in this event, I think that you will have a festival feel around those matches. They're doing fan zones around, town. There's 70 part-time staff going into Wanderers Rugby Club starting from January. That are going to be working there for 5 months building up to the finals. Like, this is a massive event coming to Ireland. And
last 16 game will potentially be the biggest game of football ever to have taken place in this country.
Yeah, I think, the Porto Braga game, just wasn't, again, it wasn't a glamour combination of a final. But, no, definitely. If you think that you could have England-Germany playing in Dublin. And as much as Gareth Southgate, he saw us coming, the twinkle-toed Irishman coming their direction, and it was like,
Were you wearing a little leprechaun suit?
Get the Guinness on. Actually, I was talking to the Polish at the time, so I came in at the end, but okay. Gareth Southgate had said,
get the Guinness on.
At some point earlier, you got the Guinness in.
Well, nobody means get it on because... You wanted to settle.
Have it ready, yeah.
Give it time to settle.
You can argue over it.
He understands that you need to give the Guinness time to settle.
The Swedish manager was like, we look forward to going to Dublin, Swedish fans like beer, so that'll be okay. Mm. So it's interesting to get a snapshot into what the actual outside perspective in Ireland is. Come here, get the Guinness on.
It's hard to know how it's all going to play out.
It's teasing you. This is strange.
Maybe it actually ultimately makes no great difference in that it's a television event for the most part. You're sitting watching games. They're not all taking place in the same country. And you get to dip in here in Dublin brilliantly if Ireland qualify, or a little bit if we don't qualify. If Ireland do qualify, everyone gets to go to Bilbao for one weekend.
It's going to be a massive pain in the arse if Ireland don't qualify. Mm. It is teasing you. There's no doubt... That I just thought being at that event the weekend and seeing the draw and seeing that, again, Ireland can't afford to be complacent about anybody. It's a bit like saying Switzerland, Denmark, that's not so bad. That didn't really work out, did it? But there is a sense that, there could have been tougher groups, and just thinking what an exciting period and week that could be building up to it. And to have that here and not to be a part of it would be pretty demoralising, I think, for people. So
playing friendlies at the Aviva the week beforehand, half empty because we haven't qualified.
Yeah, and it's like, well, the Polish team are in Carton House. Mm. No, that's nice. But
would we end up playing, because this is another thing we come to in a moment,
I don't even know why I'm discussing this. Do you think if we don't qualify, Stephen Hunt will be at me saying that I'm being negative again?
Oh, I saw that. What did he say? You should be a funeral director.
Why? Because I didn't say we were the greatest team of all time.
Yeah.
Like, come on.
I know. That was harsh.
That was very harsh. But
you should be an agent for a funeral director.
But if... Exactly. Make me some money,
there's always
please.
Work there.
If Poland and Sweden... Say we don't qualify. Do you think we would play Poland and Sweden in friendlies in Dublin...
Beforehand,
the
I can't imagine they'd come here that quickly, you know.
Give them a taste of it.
But I think, yeah, one of these mad things now as well. If Ireland lose to Slovakia, UEFA are trying to put through this thing where the two losing playoff semi-finalists play in a game in March. Now, this surely won't happen, but it is something that it's on the because of their UEFA commitment. They have to play an X amount of games. And to be honest, this centralised TV deal is worth so much money that if UEFA ask you to dance for them, you dance.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So there is a way of saying...
They need a certain amount of games at a certain time.
So like, UEFA, we won't do this, but as a result, Ireland would have to play... Now, I hope that this is irrelevant in Ireland, by Slovakia, but I'm just saying if it comes to it, that they'd have to plan this well in advance. Can you imagine Mick McCarthy, who's out of a job, basically, being told that he has to go to Bosnia the Tuesday after... the Slovakia defeat with a group of players, like that would be the ultimate test of the players'
commitment
book
to
of
the
quotes.
Calls.
The book of quotes of, well, there's no such thing as a friendly in international football. As they prepare to be a third, fourth place playoff in a League B series. Like, it won't happen, but as a result, they're going to have to play an extra game, I think, in the summer if they fail to beat Slovakia. So, yeah, I mean, it's possible. There's some talk of the Ukraine maybe being one of the teams to play here.
The Dutch?
Away to Holland. Basically, if Ireland had got by Denmark, their March games would have been Holland away and Ukraine at home. So it's possible that
they'll just push them back.
Those games could be rescheduled for the summer. So
the main takeaway from all of this is well, just qualify, but also how UEFA, like all the governing bodies, really couldn't care less about supporter experience, which we're going to see in March if Ireland beats Slovakia and somehow Irish supporters end up having to go to Bosnia.
Yeah.
5 days later, or even having to go to Belfast and there's absolutely no tickets available for it.
Yeah.
And at the World Cup, and again, looking further ahead, if things go well for Ireland, having no idea where they'll be playing in the last 16. Like you touched on it, it could be Copenhagen. There's two or three possible venues, depending on whether they finish first, second, third in the group. All of that is going to happen. So Ireland will be playing their final game in Bilbao. And if they get through, there's every chance 4 days later they're going to be playing in Copenhagen or somewhere even further afield.
Yeah, it's like, you know, Copenhagen. Actually, there is an option that would be Bilbao, bizarrely enough. But then, where's the other one? There's Copenhagen, Glasgow. But I think if you win the group, which I think would be fairly optimistic. And I think the other one is it Budapest or somewhere? I'm not sure. But either way, like it's a messy series. The one thing I would say is, though, that UEFA, and I did chat to some people at UEFA, UEFA at the moment, the current UEFA, did inherit this 12-team tournament from Michel Platini's UEFA. And I was at an event on Saturday.
He's a good guy.
Yeah. I was at this UEFA event on Saturday where they were sort of asked, could something like this happen again? And in the nicest way possible, they said, no bloody way. Germany 2024, that's when things are going to be. And when you think about it, and I did have a discussion with people, that when you think of Qatar as 2022, it's like, this 2020 is a bit of a mess. But Germany 2024 could be the rebirth of the proper international tournament. And maybe Irish football, we should just put everything to the side, forget the World Cup and Qatar, and just launch everything. Everything is about Germany 2024, when this current like crop of kids are all just coming
together
towards the prime.
Is
2024,
that
that's where you want to be.
You know, Western white man point of view.
Yes.
Germany's going to be brilliant. 2006 World Cup was the best organised World Cup we've been to. Oh, we don't want to go to Qatar. Oh, I don't really like travelling.
I take your point
distances
about that. I mean, I've been to the last three World Cups. I mean, I actually had a great time in Russia, which I didn't think was going to be that good, but it was. And it probably would have been a certain view. Oh, South America, it's awkward going to Manaus or whatever. But like, the Qatar one doesn't really tick the box for the
ruin our Christmas.
The football experience, you know, like the Qatari fans with their rich football tradition, they deserve to have a World Cup in their region. I mean, with Russia, you could make that point.
It's not the we're going down there.
We're going
a circle of.
You started off with the Nations League,
the
and we're going
grassroots
to Qatar.
The grassroots of Qatari football.
Else.
The grassroots of Qatari football.
The football
that
family.
They don't deserve to see. Unfortunately, I don't think the grassroots of Qatari football are going to get
the Qatari
next
football
near
family.
Yeah, I don't think
they already have families of substance in Qatar.
Will the Omani football family be coming across?
I don't know. When will we see Oman again? questions that we haven't asked.
We probably owed him a couple of return matches at some stage.
It's burrowed away at the bottom of a contract
somewhere. With a £50 million debt, I'd say anything is possible.
Again, I mean, so, the FA will dance for anyone.
And who'll be doing the dancing is the biggest question right now.
There is no one to dance.
John Foley stepped off the dance floor before he even got
started.
Before he even got
on.
It's
like the old school disco. It's before, like, yeah. It's the early stage. It's like Ace of Base is on or something. And Foley has not even, he's not even gone there.
So,
he's out of the building.
If anybody missed this, John Foley was due to start today as the interim FAI CEO. But he announced this morning that actually he felt there wasn't enough support from key stakeholders. And decided not to take the job. There was a statement then later on in the evening from Shane Ross, basically almost admitting that they were the key stakeholders, that they feel that anybody who had a past association with the previous regime shouldn't be involved, that they need to get as quick as possible the four independent directors and get the search for a full-time CEO underway. We get to that. What's going to happen for the next week, month, 3 months?
Yeah, listen, there's no positive spin on this in the sense that the FAI board had ratified John Foley's appointment, which again had raised some eyebrows, you know, in the sense that it wasn't just about maybe this Shane Ross thing, because Foley is thought to be very close to Sport Ireland and, you know, he's done Athletics Ireland and Cycling Ireland, so he's very much in the administrative circle. But he had been on the FAI National League Executive Committee for 12 years, which wouldn't have been regarded as a, I suppose, a particularly effective committee. So he was someone who, I mean, there's a picture of him outside Merrion Square with John Delaney, you know, Michael Cody and various other FAI, the old FAI as they might be referred to. So that possibly wasn't a great look for someone who's been brought in. I mean, they've had that with Noel Mooney and he would have faced similar questions. But I mean,
You said administrative circles there is where John Foley would have been known.
Yeah.
Like that presents part of the problem for the FAI is that they're looking for people from within Ireland who are aware of how the structures of Irish sport work, from dealing with Sport Ireland, dealing with government, and that's something that John Foley was very much on top of. Presumably that's why they brought him in the first place, was that he was aware.
Experienced head in that world. And I think, as you said there, like what is this stopgap person going to do? And it is true that this is a stopgap because the feeling is that the FAI can't appoint the next CEO, the actual replacement for John Delaney, until they have their four independent directors on the board. And it feels like they want to get the four independent directors who they'll have to oversee that process. So like the appointing of a CEO is a big job that they have to get right. So like they haven't put the advertisement out there yet. So they have to get advertisement, anyone out there is in, you know, knows recruitment and so on. Like it's gonna take
somebody
a period
for that
of time.
Type of role is gonna have to give 3-6 months notice
in their job. Exactly. So unless it's someone that you're suddenly getting someone who's out of work. So there's a lot of hurdles to cross, and the feeling was that Foley comes in now because the FAI have big decisions to make on their finances. I mean, the accounts are going to come out, they're going to outline debt, they have business plans laid out, you know, they've had UEFA helping them out. You know, I think there's a few things, you know, that are going to attract some comment building up and around the AGM about the FAI's finances. And the feeling was that, you know, they needed sort of a full-time administrator in there who could help them through that period. And
well, also I'd imagine, because if and when the figures do come out, and I think Paul Cook said at the time, we'll be shocked by the actual figure, and then the rumour of the last few weeks was somewhere heading towards 50 million, up from 20 million, cutbacks are going to be needed. And like, there is a other side of this conversation that's difficult from people, the day-to-day, people working in the FAI. There's every likelihood there'll be job losses out there. There'll have to be cutbacks. A 50 million debt,
there's going to have to be some pain somewhere. Yeah.
So who makes that decision? Because if you've 50 million debt, they're not going to say, all right, come back in 6-9 months' time and you've got a CEO and we'll hang on till then. They'll be expecting that cutbacks are made straight away. Yeah. And is there people making those decisions who have the knowledge of the structures of the FAI where they know where the cutbacks should be made?
Well, this is, I mean, they're all excellent points, and they are the issues that you're facing. Like there's, I mean, who makes those decisions? I mean, the board make those decisions ultimately, as they always have. And I think, you know, you speak to people who've been around it and they would have different opinions on where they can save money. Like there would be some people I've spoken to who would have the view, and it's a very fair one, for example, over the last decade there's been a large level of spending on the senior international management team and staff. And actually, if you spent a bit less in that department, you could probably you know, save some pain in other departments. But the flip side of that is they are the ones who can also generate, you know, 9 million by qualifying for a tournament. So that's why that spend will be justified. But there are different opinions and views. Like I said, UEFA have been in there. There might be some stuff in, you know, the papers the next day or two. UEFA would have different views on ways to save money. The FAI, there would be probably a traditional way of going, well, if you're in trouble, you just look at pay cuts or staff worries. What I do know is that their staff and FAI, more than anything, like, they're actually worried and concerned. And what's giving them that worry and concern is the absence of leadership that's there, the absence of firm leadership in the building. Because if you think about it, I mean, it's actually an interim board to a degree. Donald Connolly is going to go at some stage. He's due to go next summer. So actually, like, you are right. Like, who do they look to for that firm guidance now, for that certainty about their future? If they want to go and knock on someone's office and say, "What's my story?" I mean, now they don't have that person to actually go and see.
Is Donald Conway that person?
Well, Conway's, as far as I know, he's effectively put a lot of time into it, so he's pretty much there most days, even though he's actually only he's not an employee. Like, he's the president. It's a ceremonial title, but he's retired, so I think he's put a lot of time in there. Paul Cook is the vice president. He's a former newspaper executive. He's a chartered accountant. I think he's someone who might even have been mentioned as an alternative for the interim CEO. So there are people around the place, but they're not... like, Noel Mooney wouldn't have been a universally popular appointment at all because of his past. The one thing you would say about Mooney, and I've spoken of this in a positive sense, is that, like, he was there around the building. You know, he was trying to manage things. Now, I also, from speaking to people, that it got to the stage in a 6 month stay where after 3-4 months it's like, well, this guy's going, you know, he's not hanging around, and so his opinions only carry so much weight because, well, he's out the door. Yeah. And this is the thing, like, you need some form of certainty, and it's true, you can't necessarily have an interim person making huge decisions that your successor has to inherit. You know, this is the big strategy decisions have to be made now. And the last thing you want is some CEO defending their situation in 18 months' time and sort of saying, well, I mean, to be fair,
mistakes were made.
I inherited this. Mm. So it's not a good picture. As I said, there's no positive spin on this. I mean, best luck to the FAI. They have to try and present one. But
you mentioned Paul Cook potentially.
I mean, that's someone.
Sort of going back to Rio Walsh.
That springs to mind.
So we've had three interim CEOs. John Delaney,
yeah, you sort of forget that Ray Walsh did it for a period of time as well. I don't know. Like, I think that in an ideal world, you try and look for someone who the first thing you say about them is, well, he or she is linked to them, you know, was there for this and for that. But as you mentioned, like, you need someone who's out of work to be available to come in and help you straight away.
You can totally understand, and I think Shane Ross is probably reflecting a lot of people's views, that there needs to be a clear separation from the previous regime, the old FAI. But I'd imagine there's a lot of people in the FAI who didn't agree with what was going on, who may actually have a lot to offer. Is it right to they are thrown out and their opinions are thrown out?
I guess it just depends. The higher up the ladder they were in the FAI, the less excusable that makes... Mm. That, do you know? I mean, if it's someone that I was at a lower, like, if it's someone who worked in the FAI 10 years ago when they were low ranking member of staff and they left to go elsewhere, I don't think you can go, well, they work for the FAI. I think if it's someone who has sat on high level boards and, you know, has been involved in executive decisions that are, you know, who someone who might be mentioned in various reports as having been privy to certain decisions and so on. Like, for example, you know, this was a problem for Rhea Walsh around March, April time, that she was one of the people who was aware of the 100,000, for example. Now, she found out about after the event, but still, that's just a problem. It may seem unfair, but the optics do matter. But there's no quick resolution. Not about having the AGM now, the 28th of Saturday, 28th of December. You know, that initially has been mentioned as October, November. Now we're in 28th of December.
And independent 28th directors, of December. How can you have an AGM on the 28th of December?
Yeah. Like, but I think they're accruing small fines as they go along for every time, because I think there's company law. I think you need to get your accounts out.
Right.
You know, between a particular, you know, the 2018 accounts have to get out at a certain point, and you're into like December 2019. It's not major fines. I'm just saying, it's just they have factors to consider here. And if you're in 2020, you know, you go into 2020, into January, and we're presenting the 2018 accounts, and also they're restaging 2016 and 2017 as well. It's not great. It's just not like it's no, it's been a bad year.
That's fair enough. I think, yeah, it's been a bad year.
That's a fair description.
Fair description of the FA.
Someone referenced the reading in the year earlier, yeah.
Or has it been a good year?
No. No.
Change? Is that not good?
Reform? Yeah, that's true.
We don't have time for this right now.
No, we don't. No, that's one for...
Because Ryan is wondering, does Qatar even have grass, let alone grassroots?
That's a good point. It'd be artificial grass without a shadow of a doubt.
Boom. All right. Dan, thank you. We're going to take a quick break. And then we are going to hear from Stephen Doyle, who was at Molineux yesterday, Wolves taking on Sheffield United. And he was there alongside David Myler. We'll hear from him, his thoughts on the Premier League weekend. And also from Sheffield United and Ireland's John Egan.
Paddy Power and the Football Show. The greatest football partnership since Diofen Heskey.
Okay, I'm here with my co-commentator David Myler after what's been a pretty interesting Premier League clash. It finished Wolverhampton Wanderers 1, Sheffield United 1. We spoke after the game, David. On the balance of play, it was a pretty fair result, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think Wolves would probably be slightly disappointed they haven't gone on to win the game. Being at home, they're in a good, you know, run of form. Then again, so are Sheffield United. And I think, you know, Sheffield United started really well, got the goal, and then they kind of seemed to just set, you know, kind of was about shut up shop a little bit and look to counter-attack them, and they did create a few chances. And, you know, speaking to a few of the players after, they're a bit disappointed they didn't take them and actually go on to win the game. But I probably agree with you that a point for both teams overall is probably a fair result.
What struck me, I suppose, about the game, about the start of the game, really, was that Sheffield United were the team that tried to get on the front foot. We spoke to John Egan after the game there, and he did mention the fact that they were aware of the fact that Wolves played on Thursday night, and maybe they were looking at that as an advantage to themselves.
Yeah, and I think Wolves don't have probably 25 top players. They've got 13, 14, so they're not able to chop and change their squads. They don't have, you know, a massive squad, so of course there's going to be a slight hangover. Now, I know they've had good results after playing, you know, Europa League, but, you know, Sheffield United obviously saw it as an opportunity to come here and be on the front foot, which they were. You saw Mousset's goal after, you know, was it 90 seconds? It was just disappointing, probably, watching that Sheffield United didn't then, we've got the goal, let's go and get that second, rather than they became solid at the back and they left Wolves grow into the game, which you almost felt that a Wolves goal was inevitable, it was coming, which it did, but, you know, another day, you know, they'll learn from it.
The one thing, I suppose, for any newly promoted club, the one thing you need to have any chance of staying up, is a regular goal scorer. That's 5 goals now for Elias Moussa. It's a really good return for him so far this season. If they can keep him scoring at that rate, they have a really good chance of staying up, you'd have to say.
Well, as you said, we spoke to John Egan. John said to me, that's Moussa's 5th start and it's his 5th goal, which is, like you said, that's an incredible stat if he continues. Look, that's why goal scorers earn the money. That's why they're the top paid players in all teams. It's because they can put the ball in the back of the net. If he can continue to score, then Sheffield United will stay up. I believe they will stay up anyway. I think they have enough character. I really like the manager. I really like the squad of players. We spoke on air at the time about, you know, when they were promoted, they've kept the same core values. They've tried to play the exact same way, and I think they're really benefiting from it. I just don't want to see them change too much and keep, you know, the way they're going.
We spoke to Dave McGoldrick off the mic as well. He had to get out of town before we could speak to him, but he's getting chances. He's getting into the right positions to get goals. It's just really, we're just making sure one of those balls doesn't hit our stand here. But he just really needs to get that first goal, doesn't he? That's the important thing for him, is he's getting in the right positions.
Yeah, no, look, he's creating, and he has also been creative for where he's getting into those, you know, positions. He had probably 2 great chances. There was a corner a free kick came in, and he, you know, glanced the header, doesn't know much, but he's trying to direct it towards goal, and it's just gone wide. Another one where he was slipped in, left foot, you know, he's hit it straight at the goalkeeper. We spoke to him and he's like, I need that goal. And I think once he gets one, I think he will get a few more, because he is getting chances. It's probably just becoming a little bit of a burden on him, that, you know, everybody's expecting the work rate, you know, the link up play, everything has been brilliant for him. You're just desperate to see him get that goal.
Chris Wilder seems to be a good man manager. What does he do in this situation?
I think you just keep... Well, please God, he keeps on playing him, especially for Ireland, because we need the David McGoldrick come March that's playing regularly and whatever. I suppose that's just probably the only thing that would creep in, was that if the other strikers are Billy Sharp or Ollie McBurney are scoring all the time, then he might look to start one then. But I think McGoldrick is different than the other two in what he adds to the team. His work rate and his link-up play, like I said, is brilliant. But he just needs to start scoring.
Just looking at the other Irish players that played for the Blades in particular today, Enda Stevens just seems to be getting better and better.
Do you know what? Enda is probably a prime example of someone, you know, who played a lot of football with Shamrock Rovers, went over, you know, he had a stint at Portsmouth. I know he was played at Aston Villa, but you'd look more at his time at Portsmouth. It's someone that has, you know, played a lot of football and is comfortable. He knows his game, he knows what he's good at, he knows what he needs to improve on. But he's just taken that. And I think Enda's probably that type of player that regardless of what league he'd play in, he would play the exact same way. So if he was playing in League 2, or like he was today in the Premier League, he would play the exact same way. And I think it's great to see him, you know, play the same way, because he doesn't look out of place. And, you know, he's been brilliant for Ireland since he's come in and, you know, nailed down that left-back spot. And, like, the positions he takes up for Sheffield United are incredible. And, you know, it's just you want to see him probably get more assists. That's probably the only, like, that's me really nitpicking and being a bit harsh on him, but that's what you'd like to see.
Yeah, Grant Stafford with the lawnmower just getting the making sure the pitch stays in good nick. So if anybody's wondering what the noise is, Enda's defensive partner John Egan came back into the team today after missing that Manchester United game through injury. How did you rate his performance?
I thought John did very well. Like, obviously they'd be disappointed not to keep a clean sheet. That's what, you know, goalkeepers and defenders harp on about. But, you know, you've seen the smile on his face. He was kind of kicking himself that they didn't go on to win the game. They felt that 1-0 they should have put it to bed with the chances they created. But, like, you come to Wolves, who are, you know, on good form, they're at home, and you get a point. It's like you said a while ago, they're on 19 points so far, which is a good return. We're not even halfway through the season. But John's performance, I think he did very well, you know, especially after having that little layoff of two to three weeks, to come back in. He's in the heart of the fence, and, you know, he's key. And look, O'Connell, Basham, I know we're speaking about the Irish lads, but the three of them have a great partnership and a great understanding, and, you know, they're really the key to Sheffield United's success so far.
Just before I ask you about Wolves, your gut feeling is, would you think Sheffield United will stay up this season?
Yes. A good friend of mine is a big Aston Villa supporter, and he was harping on about Villa getting promoted and spending a lot of money, and I said Sheffield United will finish above Villa. And I said that because I think Sheffield United, I do believe they'll finish, I'm going to say, between 10th and 13th, up around there. I think that, like I said, I just love Chris Wilder, what he's about, the old British mentality, the old style, a good man manager. They kept the same philosophy from League One to the Championship. They kicked on, and then they, you know, obviously getting promoted last year, they've kicked on again this year, and they've made good signings, good players, good characters. And, you know, I'm excited to watch them play, because I like, you know, you look at the centre halves with Basham O'Connell, at times they're overlapping the wing backs, which you think is unheard of, but that's just the way he has them playing. And I saw them do it in the Championship. I played in a game with Hull, and we were hammered 5-1 by Sheffield United. We just couldn't live with their energy, and, like I said, the fullbacks high, the centre halves high, and they're doing it, like, at times there O'Connell is, you know, the highest player wide on the left forward, and it's remarkable.
Wolves have been impressive in, when you can take into consideration how Burnley did last season, trying to contend with the Europa League fixtures and the Premier League fixtures. That's two wins and three draws now for Wolves coming out of Europa League weeks, and they're still up in sixth position in the Premier League table. You have to give a lot of credit to their players and to the manager, Nuno Espirito Santo.
Yeah, no, definitely. Like I said, I don't think they have the biggest of squads. I think they've got 14 very good players, maybe 15. They've some young lads. But look, there's always that thing with the Europa League. Will there be a hangover going in on Sunday games? You have to adjust. Like, some of the, you know, the trips there out in Russia, or they're, you know, in Turkey, and it's difficult. But no, the only worry they'd have is if they picked up two or three injuries. Then you'd really worry for them. But you never want to see a professional footballer be injured or whatever, so please God that doesn't happen. But no, I love the way they play. They knock the ball around, they try and get on it. You know, Adama Traore is a concentrate with his pace. Jimenez is a big powerhouse up front with a bit of pace, and you know, he puts himself around. Then they've got the two Portuguese boys in the middle of the park, you know, who love to get on the ball, knock it about. You know, they have a very good team, and of course, I imagine we'll touch on Matt Doherty in a minute, but you know, Matt, I just...
Well, he was great out there today, wasn't he?
And no, he was.
Again, three goals in four matches, club and country. He's on a great run.
I know, and it's just all his goals are the exact same. It's just late runs into the box and getting your head on the thing. Is he a right wing back or a right back? No, he's a right forward, because at times he appeared for his goal on the, like, I don't know what, he's a striker. Like, look, he has it. The best thing Matt has, though, is when he gets into those positions, he doesn't panic. He's very calm, he's composed, and he always has a cultured finish. It's almost as if he's a natural striker, he's a natural finisher. And like you said, like that, three goals in his last four games is a great return for your right wing back.
The only thing is, he doesn't seem to get that license maybe to get forward for the Republic of Ireland as he would for his club. Is that a fair assessment?
No, it is. Of course it is. Matt plays right back for Ireland.
Yeah.
Do you know?
And that's when he plays, obviously, because Seamus Coleman generally does get ahead of him.
Yeah, but Matt's like playing right back for Ireland. We don't create like Wolves play. We don't play as expansive as Wolves do. So it's difficult. And then it comes naturally down to, is Matt as good a defender as he is going forward? He's not. Matt's key attributes are going forward. People highlighted the goal against Denmark, that Matt was at fault for his positioning, but then he goes and he gets an equaliser. Do you know? And it's a catch 22. Like with Ireland, you'd probably pick the better defender, which is Seamus, which is why I believe Seamus will play come March.
And I'll ask you about that in a moment. Before, just like, I get into the Irish stuff, there are a couple of really interesting games in the title race, which I know you're keeping a very close eye on.
Yeah.
Yesterday afternoon, who would have thought it? Manchester City, the champions, going to Newcastle, dropping 2 points. Liverpool scraping a win in the end against Brighton because they were put under pressure.
Yeah.
They were. But 11 points. If they don't win the title now, they've choked.
Well, Leicester playing this afternoon.
Well, don't worry.
Us Liverpool fans are well aware of that. Yeah, everyone thinks all Man City are 11 points, but Leicester are flying. No, look, I always said that Liverpool team were a European team. They just, you know, in the one-off games, they could, you know, at Anfield, especially in European night on a Tuesday or Wednesday, the atmosphere, and Liverpool could turn up. You know, you look at the Barcelona game, games like that where they had the big moments. But this year, they've seemed to turn that form into every game is a huge game in the league. And they're just, they've not been brilliant. They've found ways to win. Obviously, a lot of fans allude to VAR helping Liverpool out, fine, whatever. But they've found ways to win. And then, of course, you touched on Man City going to Newcastle. You know, I saw Pep Guardiola speaking about, like, how Newcastle are taking points, you know, off United, Tottenham and what have you. So he knew it was going to be a difficult game. And then, obviously, with the way the game worked out, you thought when Sterling scored that, you know, City would go on here to rump them 4-5, 6-0. But then Jethro Williams pops up. It's a lovely bit of work from Almiron. Gets his first Premier League assist. Jethro Williams scores. And then you just felt, I don't know what it was, you know, with Fernandes, Clark, Dummett, just throwing bodies on the line. And it was great. You know, we spoke in commentary about, you know, the art of defending and seeing defenders wanting to defend. You've got to want to throw your body on the line. You've got to want to block the shot. You've got to want to hit the ball. And it was great to see Newcastle. And then obviously Kevin De Bruyne produces a masterclass, you know, finish, like, out of this world. You alluded that Shelby's goal was better. I said I'd rather score De Bruyne's. But I was happy for them, you know. And, yeah, you know, when you see a team work so hard, because City dominate the ball, they knock it around, they keep it so well. When you see a team work so hard to, you know, defend well and not give any space away, not leave City create chances, you kind of feel heartbroken if they would have conceded, you know, when Sterling had the chance to make a kind of 3-2. But look, albeit Liverpool should win the league, but it's still a long way to go.
And 11 games over 34 days, isn't it, I think, this month? Like, that's this will be the real test for them. If they come out at the other end of this month and they've got a bit of a lead over City still, you'd have to say that they're over the worst of it.
Yeah, but like Fabinho being out till the new year is a big loss. I still think Liverpool can cope with it. You know, they'll just... Cade is coming back. So you'll have like Wijnaldum, Cade, Henderson, Milner. They have enough players there. So I don't think it'll be that big of an issue. I hope I've not jinxed it. Obviously, Alisson getting the red card. Straight red, I believe, is 3 games. So Adrian now will have to step in. Plus, so it'll be interesting. Hopefully, we might see Quivín Kelleher get a little run out in the game. Another Cork man. Love to see the Cork men do well. no, but it's in Liverpool's hands. I would love them to sacrifice Europe for the Premier League. Obviously, being the reigning champions, it kind of doesn't work like that. And when you're successful and when you're winning games, you have more games. So, like I said to you, Liverpool, yes, they've got a lot of games coming up over the next 34 days. But Liverpool players will probably hardly ever train. It'll just be game, recover, recover, game. And if they continue, if they just keep going with the run of form they are, winning games, then there's no stopping them.
They'll be celebrating the Ringmahon Rangers if Quivín gets into a Premier League team. Just to ask you about the Irish stuff as well, because obviously we had that draw last night for the group stage.
Didn't look at it. No interest.
You're going to, next game, you're only concentrating on the next game.
There's no people, you know. I had my buddies text me going, we could be playing X, Y, and Z. Yeah, but we've got to go on. We've got to beat Slovakia. And then if we beat Slovakia, we've got to beat the winners of Bosnia and Northern Ireland. Like, you're 2 games away from looking at what the draw is. Of course, look, it'd be great to see, you know, look, I want us to be there. You know, I remember Italia 90. I looked at photos the other day. I was back home coaching with the Ireland 17s. So I was back up home and my mum produced photos of me, like, looking at Italia 90 and won. You know, USA 94, I'm running around in an Ireland kit. Like, and I love it. And, do you know what I mean? I would love to take my son, you know, over to watch Ireland and, you know, say, like, you know, your old fella used to play. Like, so, look, but I'm getting ahead of myself now and I shouldn't. We have to concentrate in Slovakia. I'm not even a player, and that's the way I'm thinking. And I know the players, I know Mick would be thinking like that. Just deal with Slovakia, one game at a time. And it should, well, it's only one game really, because you don't have a second one coming if it doesn't go well. So just focus on Slovakia, and I believe we will beat Slovakia.
And just as you funny, because I spoke to you about this earlier, you actually don't think it's such a bad thing that we're away from home?
No, like we spoke, as you said, off air, and I said I've had great moments in Irish shirt, but a lot of them have been away from home. You know, with the Germany game, the Austria game, the Wales game. I don't know what it is. We seem to be backed in a corner and we're away from home and we just put on a performance and we pull a performance and we pull a result and I believe we'll do it.
Paddy Power and the Football Show. The greatest football partnership since Duff and Heskey.
John, thanks for stopping. How are you feeling after the game? I suppose you did have the lead and then Wolves come back, get the equaliser, so what's the, I suppose, the general mood after it?
I suppose you take a point there, but I think earlier on in the game we probably could have, you know, got one or two more before they came into it, and I think after Doc scored, I think we were probably on the back foot for the last 20 minutes, and, you know, it's obviously good to come away from here with a point, but I think if we'd maybe took some of our chances before that, we might have come away with all three.
I know from checking the games beforehand, very rarely you either score or concede in the opening 15 minutes. Was it a real plan to come to Wolves and to go at them on the front foot?
Yeah, look, we know they played Thursday night and they travelled and, you know, you might be a bit leggy, so we wanted to start fast. We did start fast and got the goal, and, you know, I thought we did quite well and started the second half really well. You know, created 3 or 4 good chances, and just unfortunately none of them went in today to try and kill the game off. But, you know, coming here, they're always going to have a spell, and I think last 20 minutes they had that spell and we did well to weather it.
Andy Stevens playing some great stuff at the moment as well, is he?
Yeah, he's playing brilliant. You know, he's getting better and better every game he's playing, and I think he's probably, you know, one of, if not the best left back in the Premier League so far this season, and, you know, hopefully he can keep that going.
The game against Manchester United obviously last week was, you know, I think maybe most Sheffield United supporters afterwards felt that even though you were 2-0 up, probably happy to get the point because you'd gone 3-2 down. You get another point this week, like, you're up to 19 now, not even halfway through the season. You must be pretty optimistic that you are going to stay up in the Premier League.
Yeah, but we just take it game by game. You know, we don't really look back, we look ahead, and we want to you know, we want to win games. The last three games, we had Tottenham away, Man U at home, Wolves away. You know, we wanted to win those games, and we could have easily won all three. I think we controlled the game and down in Spurs, and we controlled 70 minutes against Man U, and you know, we controlled the game for a long time today, but we just didn't get over the line. And you know, I think overall, you look at it, you're playing against top sides. They're going to have moments, and they're going to maybe score when they're on top, and I think we've just been punished a bit, but I think the main thing is the performances are good, and we're not afraid of anyone, and I think it shows on the pitch.
Yeah, you're sticking to what makes you such a good team as well. Like, you're not changing anything. Even last week, Manchester United changed their tactics and formation to match you guys. Like, that's a huge sign of respect towards Sheffield United.
Yeah, I think teams are probably you know, getting to know about us, but we're not going to change. You know, we're going to play the way we play. It's effective. Got good results from doing that. We've had success from doing that last year, the year before that. So, you know, we're not going to change. We're going to keep going, and we're going to try and keep improving as the season goes on, and try to keep getting points.
Regards to your own fitness, you obviously missed last week because of that head injury you got in for Ireland in the Denmark game. How's that dealt with over the couple of weeks?
Listen, just missed the game through injury. Back training this week, and you know, thankfully the gaffer put me straight back in, and you know, these things happen in football, and just looking forward to the next game now.
You had a bit of time to think about the Denmark game. Now, obviously disappointment that Ireland couldn't get the win. How are you feeling about it now?
Yeah, obviously at the time very disappointed. I thought, you know, they obviously came to take a draw, and I thought we were on top for most of that game, and probably got caught with a little sucker punch, but you know, we look forward to the playoffs now, and we full belief that we can, you know, go to Slovakia, get a good result, and then, you know, hopefully get to the Euros.
Have you been having a look at Slovakia's performance and results over the last few months?
Yeah, obviously you don't know too much about them until you get closer to the game and analyse it, but you know, every game is tough, and we just want to qualify, so we'll try to do whatever it takes to do that.
Regards to the group as well, did you keep an eye on the draw last night?
Yeah, I did, yeah. Obviously every group is going to be tough, so we got to get there first, and you know, then we can start worrying about that.
Does that make it though, you know, is it a bit of a carrot in a way, because you know you're facing such great sides like Spain and Sweden in that group?
To be honest, I'm not even thinking about it until we get there, because you can't look past Slovakia at the moment. It's all well and good thinking about carrots and thinking about teams, but we're not in the Euros yet, and still have a lot of work to get there.
Just a matter of interest as well, like, you know, obviously Stephen Kenny's going to be coming in to take over Mick next year. Like, with the senior players like yourself, would you be keeping an eye on what's going on with the under-21s and how well they're doing at the moment?
Yeah, you keep an eye on the results and stuff, but, you know, they're doing great. We had a couple of them come in training, you know, Lee and Troy made their debuts, and yeah, it's great for them, but we have to concentrate on the big games that we have, and, you know, obviously it's great to see the 21s doing so well, and hopefully that bodes really well for the future of Irish football.
Thanks, John, for stopping.
Paddy Power and the Football Show, the greatest football partnership since Diouf and Heskey.